You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Thank you all for joining us. We have Asim here today, one of our fellows from Pakistan, or visiting from Pakistan, and Rachel has very kindly agreed to moderate this discussion, so maybe we can just throw it open to Rachel and to Asim and look forward to a good conversation.
Sure. Well, I'm not going to talk very much because Asim has so much to say and so much to show you that I'll be very brief. But just to say that I'm with the Regional Policy Initiative working on Afghanistan and Pakistan, and from our perspective, Asim is a very exciting fellow and a great sort of advert for the fellowship programme, actually, because I just got back from Pakistan a week ago where Asim was... I met with Asim and another partner of ours called the Justice... JPP, Justice...
Project Pakistan.
And Matt's here.
And Matt Bay actually is from JPP.
Great. And Asim has been working very closely with this partner on some of their work on torture and some of our work on Bagram. And we had a meeting with a range of partners, and I think by the end of the meeting we were all saying, how can we clone Asim and have him with, you know, half the rest of our partners as well? And it's a good challenge to us in terms of our levels of creativity in some of our campaigning and advocacy work. And I think, you know, he does have some sort of pointed questions about how we conduct our campaigning, which I look forward to later. But obviously,
that's a personal conversation, really. In the conference room.
No. I think it should be shared with all of us. Fellowship program love us to challenge our own lazy thinking. That's what it's all about. Tick box. But the scope of his work is huge. He will describe the full extent of it. But he's looking at justice in Pakistan. It's very ambitious, and I think it just grows the more time he spends there. He's about halfway through his fellowship at the moment. I'm hoping he's going to come back in a couple of months' time and talk us and show us some of his work on Bagram. So we're probably going to leave that for this session. But he's got a whole range of issues, other issues he's working on, including death penalty, torture, structural injustice, persecution of Hazaras, and, of course, the war on terror. With that, I'll hand over to Asim, and he can, you know, explain what the work of a documentary photographer is.
Amy's here to correct me. Thank you very much for coming. My name is Asim Rafiki. I thank you, Vipasha, for having me speak here. I wanted to, because I'm in the midst of the project and have not arrived at any conclusions, so this talk is actually going to go and sweep across a number of different topics and subjects. But what I actually really wanted to do in the process was not just to leave you with some idea about the justice project itself, but also to talk a little bit about the method of a photographer, and sort of explore a little bit about how the work that I'm producing and how I'm producing it is very much tied to the way I work as a photographer, and that would also help you understand how some of the issues that I'm trying to explore will emerge out of the project. So, if you will just indulge me in the next 40 minutes or so, we will talk about this discussion is going to weave through some hopefully unexpected places. You know, being a fellow is actually a great honor, especially as a photographer. It's quite unusual, and I remember Vipasha and I talked about this a lot when I was applying, and I've taken that opportunity to try and produce something that's a little bit different, rather than go the predictable route and stay with sort of the conventional methods of photography. I'm trying to produce a work that, in a way, is a testament to the fellowship, and that it will be unique, and it will be something that the kind of work that has not been produced from or about Pakistan in the past. So that would, for me, would I think would be a wonderful place to arrive at the end of the year, would be to leave this unique body of work and a unique effort given the opportunity I have here. So I'm going to talk a little bit about photography first, and we can just keep this informal. Hi, how are you? One of the least examined issues or questions for a photographer is a question of method. And typically, a photographer has a method, and we are now sort of established in a world where we have some pretty well-defined categories of photography, of photojournalism, of documentary photography. We see this in the way certain kinds of works make it into competitions. We see this in the way that the Open Society works with photographers. But it's something that we don't really examine, that we don't explore as photographers. We all have a particular way of working, and some people call it their eyes, some people call it their style and technique and so on. But what's not really examined is how a method constrains what you work on. And more often than not, given photographers work with a certain fixed approach, they tend to pick subjects that best suit the method, and if something doesn't fit it, they will typically not cover it. So we see this a lot in photojournalism or in documentary photography, where the issues you want to cover need to have an overpowering visual, often chronological, linear structure. And if it gets too complicated, too sophisticated, too abstract, you tend to drop these issues. One of the consequences of that, and I will speak predominantly about documentary photography and photojournalism because that's the background I come from and that's sort of how I have been working over the last many years. As a consequence of that, what has happened, and this we've heard this complaint come up quite a bit, that photojournalism and documentary photography sort of narrowed itself down to a certain set of subjects and themes, which we see keep sort of repeating themselves. Stephen Mays from Seven talked about this when he was speaking about World Press Photo. We saw it again this year. And you see a lot of photographers over the years who sort of keep staying with the same kind of subjects, and there's a reason for that, and it's obviously because there are certain things that visually that sort of are available to the camera in a much more vivid fashion. We see certain subjects like drug addiction or Alzheimer's and war, which tends to be the most popular one because it sort of all unfolds in front of us and it looks fantastic on film. But as a consequence, what happens is that what you're trying to cover gets narrower and narrower, and there's not so many places that you know, that one can go. There have been, of course, some wonderful photographers who have attempted to break that pattern. We've just speaking like Jim Goldberg from Magnum has done some amazing work where he's tried to break this particular pattern while addressing some very important issues, particularly recently on immigrants in Europe. We have seen Alex Soth take his camera and try and do documentary photography, but in a much more artistic way. And then you have Susan Mizales, whom you all know really well, whose work, AKA Kurdistan, in fact, I think remains one of the very unique efforts quite early on to break this pattern and do a very important story, but not do it in the conventional photojournalism way. And I think that that particular work hasn't been examined enough for what it had tried to do and how it had tried to break certain patterns. And then I think worse, it hasn't been emulated enough by younger photographers coming in after her. But despite that, what has remained central to these photographers is that the photograph remains central. In the end, a photographer hangs everything around a photograph, and then everything sort of captions and text and introductory work, it sort of hangs around it like accessories. The point of departure for a photographer is the photograph, and the destination, in the end, is the photograph. This is true for Jim, whose photographic work may be very complex, but it is the photograph, and same is true for Alec or anyone else. You are a photographer and you produce a photograph, and that's what, in the end, really matters. That in itself continues to create a problem, which is that once again, if you're working with an issue that is can't literally simply be photographed, you tend to be constrained. And if your principal product is a photograph and you're starting and ending with it, you are still limiting yourself to where you can go with an issue and how far, particularly as a documentary photographer. Now, since 2000, so I spent 7-8 years working with mainstream magazines and covering documentary photography projects and photojournalism issues, but this issue kept bothering me because in the process of exploring certain questions as a working photographer, it was obvious that there were certain issues that I did want to explore, but I didn't have the method to actually do them justice. I had these toolkits that were given to me by the Missouri School of Photojournalism or through my time with Time Magazine and others, but they were not adequate for the kinds of work that, or the kinds of issues that were becoming increasingly interesting to me. So in 2008, I ventured off to do a certain experiment and to see if I could actually do something a little bit different, which I wasn't sure if it would work. But the idea was this, not to start with a photograph and not to start with an issue. And the idea was that you would have a general theme and you would walk into that theme and into an environment where that theme existed. and you would allow your experiences in that environment, your conversations, your discussions, your travels, to provoke certain questions. And you would use those questions to move towards certain images and towards certain writings and towards certain explorations. That was sort of the concept. So I wanted to liberate myself from this idea that I am a photographer and I produce photographs, and I must go where there are going to be cool photographs, and then we'll figure out how to, you know, sort of hang these things around. So we, that was the work that I went to work on and produce in India. That was in 2008, 2009, and but there was an overarching interest in issues of history and intercommunal violence. That's sort of how this began. And we had been documenting and talking about sectarian violence in India, and of course then the conflict between India and Pakistan. But it wasn't evident to me how actually I would try and photograph that. How do you photograph a historical reality whose threads take you back a few hundred years? It sort of manifests itself in these riots, and this, you know, we had seen the situation unfolding in Ayodhya and in Gujarat and so on. But the riots never really adequately captured the issue in itself and the kinds of things that we really wanted to explore. But I wanted to do something about this. So off we went to India, and it was there that I started working. I'm going to show you a few things.
Oh, sorry, I think I need to log back in.
Right. So I'm sorry, we didn't have the right Mac connectors, so we ran right back to the PC world. As anathema as that is. Now, before you start wondering why am I going through all this discussion, it's because it's actually quite central to the way the Justice Project is actually going to fall out. So what happened is that I decided that, okay, I don't have an idea of what I'm going to photograph and how I'm going to photograph, and more importantly, I don't have an idea of how I'm actually going to talk about anything. But the approach I took was to go to India. We were looking for issues of sectarian violence, and I would travel into a site or a location where that was known to be an issue. And I would actually sit and meet people. I would live there for a few weeks. I would talk to people from the various communities, and I would allow something interesting to fall out. So, for example, Somnath is a town in the south of Jamnagar. And it is one of the sites of a very famous temple called the Somnath Temple, around which a very important story of Indian nationalism was woven in 1947. And it remains in this region one of the principal sites around which the idea of the Muslims as a foreign invading force was constructed. And that narrative of Muslims as being outsiders to India, as being temple desecrators, as being invaders, was very much built into the history of a new India emerging in 1947, and the Somnath Temple played a big part of that in that story. So what I tried to do was, rather than simply go in and write, and by the way, this actually should be a slideshow that should run, and that depends on the speed of your internet. So what I would do is that I would travel into a site, and I would basically spend time there, talk to people, and let the questions fall out, or something that I would experience in the site provoke a thought. So for example, around Somnath, what one found was that the community that lives around this temple is largely Muslim, which actually took me by surprise, and it still is. And while exploring and examining that question, I began to unveil the actual history and story of how this town actually came to be, the role it played in Indian history, and how that history was used to create certain divisive sectarian ideas. And that led to my spending time, of course, and photographing, but also led to what many have called these long 4,000 plus page discussions on the Somnath Temple and its role in history and how it had been used and where some of those histories were coming from. And yes, they are long and they're unedited, but you know, that's basically what was happening at that time. Similarly, I went into Ayodhya, which is a town that I'm sure a lot of people here know. We had the conflict on the Babri Mosque It was one of the principal sites of Hindu-Muslim riots from the early 1990s. And I wanted to go in again. I went into this town, I lived there, and I allowed discussions with people I met, which could be pundits, and it could be religious leaders, it could be local citizens, to provoke certain questions. So for example, in Ayodhya, I was standing at the bathing ghats one morning, and I met some people who started to tell me sort of a modern history of Ayodhya, and they mentioned the fact that the Muslims were determined to destroy the entire city of Ayodhya. And yet they were not able to explain the fact that the Muslims had, the Ayodhya in fact had been under Muslim rule for some 350 years, and somehow they had not managed to destroy it. And so that provoked a question, which I went on to write a piece called, The Temple Desecration and Acts of Conquest, which is actually an exploration of the research done on temple desecrations and to the extent to which they were actually done, and also led to the realization that Ayodhya became a principal site of Hindu pilgrimage under Muslim rule, under the Awadhi leadership, and then evolved into the important religious center that it is. So the entire method that this project became, which event was known at, well, I gave it a working title of Idea of India, which I finished in 2011, was based around this idea. No photographs in mind, no issue that was explicitly being explored, certain sites that I had mapped out that I wanted to investigate, and then you go in and you allow your experience on the ground to provoke certain questions and to lead you towards certain kinds of photographs. It's an instinctive approach as a photographer. It doesn't tie into a literal documentation, and it was an instinctive approach intellectually as well. So the questions that were emerging were not based on any particular framework, but it did allow me to spend 3 years in India and explore the country from Kashmir to Kerala in a very open-ended way around some of these issues that are beginning to interest me. There are obviously continuities between the India work and the Pakistan work. And many people have asked me, like, well, where does that come from? The justice work in Pakistan actually emerged out of work I was doing in India. And one of the consequences of doing extensive research, so there's a huge dorky bibliography of materials that were read. But while reading a lot of this post-colonial research, one of the things I noticed was that many books had chapters on the law, which were always the chapters I skipped because they were dense and kind of boring, but it just kept staying that they were talking about. Bernard Cohen had done this, Walter Washbrook had done this, there were all these chapters, and you'd be like, that's interesting, let's just move on. At one point, it began to dawn on me, there was a book I read called Orientalism and the Post-Colonial Predicament, which was the only study I had read of the institutional continuities of the colonial state. And that's a subject that hasn't really been examined. But what this book tried to explore was that in so-called post-independence period, many of the social, legal, civic government institutions that had been designed and built during the colonial era were carried forward into the independent states, and they actually continued to operate in the same way and carried with them some of the prejudices of behavior and priorities that they had been designed for initially, like, for example, the civil service of India or Pakistan. But more importantly, for example, the law, the legal system. So the Pakistan legal system remained largely designed around the Indian Penal Code of the 19th century, and it carried forward many of the same sort of presumptions about society, presumptions about morality, presumptions about the validity of laws and what have you. And it was at that point when I started to come back, to travel back to Pakistan, as I was wrapping up this work, I needed to go back to read those chapters on the law. And I realized that there was actually something interesting to explore here, because one of the struggles that kept popping up in Pakistan was the disconnect between the law and the citizenry claimed to be serving. And we had seen this emerge perhaps most vividly in the conflict in Swat, where many of the religious groups or many of the militant groups had exploited this gap between the formal legal code and the state and the lack of justice in the country. And in fact, one of the most common memes used by militant groups, actually even in southern Punjab, was a promise of quick, efficient justice. You will see this again and again. It may not be great justice, it may not be justice at all, but they promised you results very quickly, which is precisely what the existing system was not able to do. So that actually, that thought brought me into, had me thinking about looking at questions of justice in Pakistan, and I and it sort of felt like a continuation of the work that I had been doing in India. And so what I arrived in Pakistan to do, which is the project which is now unfolding, is a work that sort of sits between the law as it exists today on paper and notions of justice in the country. So what I am doing here is what's in between, what's in the gap between the way the law sits in the constitution and your legal codes and what people's ordinary ideas are of what justice ought to be and how it should be, because we are that space in between is what's constantly being negotiated or manipulated or abused. The way the project has been structured is primarily through individual stories. So what is, if someone asks me what this project is going to be, I always say it's 300 short stories. And the idea has been to use the lived experience of the law as a way to provoke a conversation about ideas of justice. So once again, if you think back to what I did in India, I'm coming at this project by meeting what I consider to be some of the most marginalized communities in Pakistan. And I don't mean marginalized economically, I mean marginalized in terms of the interest of the law, the communities that are furthest from the formal legal system. And spending time with them and actually listening to their stories or a particular experience and using them to raise questions about justice and the law. How do they perceive the law, or what would be justice, and where do they feel that justice is failing them? So rather than trying to take a law and see if it's working or not, I'm actually questioning or raising questions about what justice ought to be. And it's also what it's also allowing me to do is reflect certain ideas of values, morality, that may not be reflected in the legal system that we already know is wasn't designed from the society upwards, but in fact was imposed from an imported colonial law downwards. Because it's in that gap that all the problems actually exist in Pakistan. So we, I will just show you some examples. Vipasha and I were talking a little bit earlier. It's so basically we, for example, some of the issues that I'm covering. We started working on issues of the death row prisoners and death penalty. And the reason why I looked at that issue was that it was quite evident that the death penalty, as you listen to ex-death row prisoners, was actually or murder cases, sorry, and death penalty was actually being used to veil other interests. So a lot of the death penalty cases that I was able to examine were actually about land disputes. And they were a way of resolving land disputes. So one of the quickest ways to sort out a land dispute problem is to get someone caught up in a murder case, pay off the police to have a case filed against them, have them thrown into jail, pay off the judge to send put them on death row, and that gets you 11 years to 12 years in prison, during which time you pretty much lose all your assets, you lose your hold on the land, your opponents can grab it, and by the time you come out, you don't have any resources left to fight it. It's actually more efficient than resolving that dispute through the courts, which may take 30, 35 years. So I traveled into rural Punjab and we started meeting these people who were telling you these stories about how so much of what they were dealing with had to do with an old land dispute, or it had to do with, as Rich and I were talking in the case of this particular woman, the fact that in the Punjab there remains a very severe resistance to allowing women to inherit land. So female disinheritance remains one of the most powerful incentives for the politics of the region and for many of the crimes that are committed in the region. So for example, Sardani Kosar was actually sent to prison. She spent 11 years in prison on murder charges for having murdered her husband. But in fact, what had happened is that her husband's children from his first wife arranged for his murder, put the blame on her, and had her thrown into prison because she would stand to inherit land from her husband, which is what they didn't want to allow. It would actually mean the breakup of the estate and the ownership of property. So she spent 11 years, after which, when she emerged, she had no resources, she cannot fight the case. They remain in possession of the land, and they remain in possession of the property, and everything has been resolved, and you move on. We had a similar case with another gentleman in a different part of Punjab. This is Ashraf Banga. He was, again, another case of a land dispute that was resolved by actually concocting the murder of a low-level peasant and blaming it on him and actually having him thrown into jail for 11 years, at which point they actually, you know, during which time they had taken over the land, even taken his crops, in fact, which he had actually grown at that time. And then by the time he came back, he actually has no resources and no legal recourse to actually fight to get that land back. So another land dispute that gets resolved through the courts as a murder case and death penalty and so on and so forth. So I'll keep moving. So death penalty has been one of the important issues. Now the stories that you hear, the time you spend with them, these are the sort of nuances that fall out of any one of these discussions that you wouldn't really be able to experience if you were working from the system downwards. But furthermore, what's also been interesting is that the issue of the death penalty has been this question of, well, what do you do about it, which has been, when I first started working with Justice Project Pakistan, their team members were the ones who actually took me into these communities because they have some actually ex-prisoners working with them as research staff, which makes a huge difference, and I think it's quite unique in Pakistan in terms of how an organization works. And the question that keeps coming up in issues of death row is, what are the alternatives? And what this work would be trying to do is actually suggest why Pakistan should stop the death penalty and what the alternatives are going to be, which is, by the way, a discussion largely missing in Pakistan right now. We have a lot of organizations trying to stop the death penalty, but very few who actually have a concrete idea of what the alternative would be. So by the end of the year, I hope to have some work done on that also. Early this year, I traveled to Quetta, which was just by coincidence. So around the time that I was heading to Quetta, there was the first suicide bomb attack on Alamdar Road, which killed 102 people. My initial exploration of the Hazara Shia community, which at the moment is under siege in the country, and we've had a second bomb attack in Quetta. My interest principally was the question of Pakistani citizens beginning to see themselves or construct themselves as a minority. And that is a construction. So as in a state with a deep and sort of homogenous sense of its national identity, how do communities that don't fit into that sort of majority idea view themselves, construct themselves, and the language that they use, and then how does that affect the way they employ the law to fight for certain rights? And the Hazara have been actually quite a vivid example of a community that up until perhaps 15 years ago spoke of itself as Pakistanis and is now suddenly, in the last 15 years, has been speaking of itself as a minority and as Hazara. This is a term that has become much more prevalent in recent memory as opposed to having been there since the nation was set up. So I traveled here to meet members of this community. I traveled very soon after the blast, which of course made all the conversations incredibly intense, but at the same time quite vivid and explicit about how they see their rights, how they see the law protecting them or not protecting them, and then the political unions that they're creating to fight for certain legal structures to defend them. And interestingly, they're all around this idea of being a minority, which as a Pakistani I found incredibly troubling, but that is part of what we are going to explore in this subject. The work on the Hazara, of course, the Hazara community in Quetta is highly ghettoized. So here again, you see a term that in fact has certain histories to it: ghettoization, minorities. Amir Mufti has done some amazing work looking at the parallels between the history of the Jews in Europe and a certain language that traveled with them through the 17th post-Enlightenment period, and how that language was transferred to the colonies in the 18th and 19th century. And one of that being ghettoization and secular liberal democracy and so on, and how that language is now used for Muslims in India. And we find it, interestingly, emerging in Pakistan and when it comes to the Hazara. What that means for them legally, what legal protections, what legislative protections will emerge is actually an interesting question, because it's going to require, they're going to look for special interests, and how, and so we are watching this process unfold. But the project will, here I've actually mapped out the communities in which the Hazara live. So here you actually have photographs, audio, and we actually will put up some video there. So as you click through the map, you can actually walk around in this neighborhood. You can actually listen to poets who live there. We use the poetry as a way to talk about the experience of the Hazara. So their poems actually capture basically what their current situation is. And so we try to give a sense of, there are actually two ghettos, and I'm using that word because that's how they're referred to now, but there are two neighborhoods where this community has basically retreated into. I'm just going to touch briefly on a couple of one other subject, and this is a broader subject. So personally, one of the issues that really interested me is this question of structural injustice, which is, doesn't relate to the law or what's unlawful, but it relates to certain political, social, economic structures that deprive certain communities of certain rights or certain liberties. And they may all be legal, they may be lawful, they may be historical, but they're incredibly debilitating. And the way I'm trying to examine that issue is that by looking at three or four communities. They include informal laborers arriving from rural areas. We're looking at bonded laborers who are fleeing land tenement bondage. We're looking at the fishing community along the Arabian Sea coast, which is facing a loss of livelihood because of environmental problems and because of mass fishing rights that are being sold in the Arabian Sea. So these are small-scale farmers fishing. And we're using their experiences, their individual stories, to reveal these structures of injustice, as we are calling them. So this idea is based around, of course, Iris Marion Young's work and Paul Farmer's work and Gutierrez and others who looked at and tried to explore certain arrangements that benefit a certain group but leave a very large percentage of people in these incredibly sort of constrained and difficult and what we would call unjust arrangements. So garment factory workers, their stories help me understand where they're coming from, why they're drifting into the slums of Karachi, most all of which are largely uninhabitable. They're incredibly violent, life is incredibly precarious, and yet these people are leaving behind something that they consider to be even worse. So the questions that I'm asking is, what's that thing that's even worse? And why are these slums growing at this pace that they're growing, while at the same time the state is also eviscerating any and all labor protection rights and welfare and pensions and what have you for people working in one of the largest industries and the most international industry in the country. It's an interesting series of phenomena. So the individual stories are kind of helping me sort of piece out some of those things. All right, and we can talk about 10 minutes, 5 minutes?
5 minutes.
All right. So the last thing I wanted to quickly talk about is one of the important things in the project, of course, is how do we get some of these stories out? And it's this whole issue of advocacy and engagement. So what we've been doing is, for example, I'm working very closely with organizations like Justice Project Pakistan, which are people who are actually working in the field. We've designed and working on designing two projects around torture, one project around torture in Pakistan, and the other one around the issue of Bagram detainees. And we are sort of collaborating in a way that it's not just about my giving them photographs, but we're actually designing campaigns that use multimedia, that use the stories that I'm collecting to launch the reports in a new fashion, and in the torture project case, to actually go out into the public in a new way. So we are trying to break, as Bipasha and Christine and I were talking earlier, we are trying to break certain patterns of advocacy that have existed in Pakistan, where certain kinds of discourse has now become norm, and it's not really moving the conversation into a new direction, or at least not provoking the conversation in a new direction. And we're trying to break those old conversations, at least get people to re-engage by trying to do some new and different things. At the same time, I am an artist in residence at the main university in Lahore. So we're bringing in and weaving in a lot of students into the project who are collaborating with me on some of my work that I'm doing with the organization. And we're pushing them out to do their own work. So for example, the the factory firework in Karachi has led to students doing similar work in Lahore, and then it also has led to them starting to do multimedia work on a labor dispute that's actually taking place in the university itself, which I actually did get a warning letter from the dean because I was supporting this group of students to help organize this group of janitors at the university. But we can talk about that later. But anyhow, so that's sort of how the project is being taken out into the field, and it's being done as I'm doing the work. So we're not waiting for the project to finish. The photographs are done. The work of engaging the community around me is taking place just as I am engaging the community around me to produce the photographs and capture the stories.
It's a wonderful project, and thank you so much for your time in sharing the beginnings of this project with us. And I look forward to hearing from you again at a later stage in the project. I think this is going to be a long conversation. So thank you very much for the time and this really extraordinary project.
Thank you very much.